I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Phil Huff. He's the executive director for the Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness, and we're talking about keeping the wild, Peter. We've got a lot of it in Idaho, and boy, it should be nice to keep more and more of our lands protected so that future generations can enjoy it too, right?
You know, we've talked about this before. About 60% of our land in Idaho is public land. And this is going to be a great talk about the Scotchman Peaks because it is public land, but they're also working on it being a designated wilderness area. Added protection.
We'll talk about what that designation means, what you can and can't do on those lands. We've had a few guests over the seasons, I guess, talking about wilderness areas, but we'll dig into that. And also, what that region has to offer.
Right. It's a great area. This is one of the spots that, closing in on 9 years in Idaho, I have yet to go up to the north part of Idaho, and I need to make it up there.
Right on. Well, we'll dig into that soon. But first, nature in the news, Peter.
Right. So, Leif, have you heard of the Stanford Marshmallow Test? This was done back in the early 70s, like 1972. And they were working with children, and they would offer them one marshmallow as an immediate reward, or if they could wait for a certain period of time, they would actually get two marshmallows.
Right.
And so this is actually kind of like
this is impulse control.
Right? And okay. It also helps. It's a good marker of intelligence. So if you can delay that impulse control, that's a sign of greater intelligence, especially in humans and chimpanzees.
Okay.
Well, we've got some researchers at the University of Cambridge, and they wanted to see if the Eurasian jay, a member of the corvid family, also exhibits this impulse control. Now, corvids are insanely intelligent. They really are.
So those are crows.
Crows.
Magpies are in
magpies,
there?
Magpies, right. Jays, ravens.
Right.
They actually, the majority of these corvids are more intelligent than quite a few of our parrots. They just don't mimic our vocalizations
you
as well.
You said parrots or parents?
Parrots and parents.
Be careful.
Yeah, I should be careful, right?
Right.
So they really wanted to see if they've got these this impulse control. And one of the reasonings behind it is jays cache food. And they need to – two things. They need to be patient when they're hiding the food because they want to make sure no other jay or a squirrel is watching them hide. They don't want to give that location away. And then when it's time to move back and eat – again, they have to be patient. They don't want to give away those locations of their food supplies. And so with this research, it's actually really kind of cool. They had an immediate reward of two options. It was bread or cheese. And so with their birds, it varied between birds, but the bread and cheese were their second and or third favorite food item, their first being mealworms. And if they could delay that bread or cheese, then they would receive a mealworm.
A tasty mealworm.
And the delay times ranged from 5 seconds to 5.5 minutes.
Huh.
So can you guess how long one Eurasian jay waited to receive a mealworm?
I'm going to go with 5.5 minutes.
It was 5.5 minutes. It was absolutely crazy how long.
That's
she
great.
Waited, and she had some distraction techniques. She would look away from the food item, pretend to be busy doing other things, and she could wait a whole 5.5 minutes.
That's pretty good.
Now, the shortest time, the most impatient jays could go for 20 seconds. So, again, that's pretty
seconds.
Darn good.
Yeah.
Waiting 20 seconds before they said, you know what, I'm going to have this piece of cheese or piece of bread. And the delay also kind of depended on whether the cheese or the bread was their second or third favorite. If their third favorite was up, it was a lot easier for them to wait for that mealworm. If the second favorite showed up, they couldn't wait as long.
Corvids.
They're smart.
They're bright. They're very bright.
Yep.
Well, today we're talking wilderness, and the Wilderness Act was signed into law on September 3rd, 1964. Today's trivia question is, what other significant act was signed into law on that date? Well, when we come back from the break, Phil Huff will join us to talk about Scotchman Peaks Wilderness Area, and he'll also answer that question, so stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Here at NPR, we try to reach all kinds of listeners.
My name is Leo, and I'm 8 years old.
And we take feedback very seriously.
I never hear much about nature or dinosaurs or things like that.
So when Leo wrote us about our appalling lack of dinosaur coverage on All Things Considered, we knew we had to talk to him. Hi, Leo.
Hi.
I hear from your parents that you want to be a paleontologist when you grow up, and now we've got one on the line for you.
Okay.
Let me let you ask a question.
How did dinosaurs grow to be so big?
This is hard-hitting journalism, because these are the types of questions that keep paleontologists up at night.
In public radio, we value our relationship with each and every one of our listeners. You listen to us, and we listen to you too. So keep our connection strong. Donate to this station right now. Here's how.
You know who covers dinosaurs really well? The Nature of Idaho on KISU. Support NPR and KISU programs by visiting KISU.org and click donate.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome today's guest, Phil Huff. He's Executive Director for the Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness Area. So first off, thanks for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
My pleasure. Thank you, Leif and Peter, for having me.
Why don't we start where we usually do with our guests. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure, absolutely. I'm the executive director of an organization called the Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness. And so we formed 18 years ago to advocate for the wilderness designation by Congress of the Scotchman Peaks roadless area. 2005, the Idaho Panhandle Forest in Idaho and the Kootenai National Forest in Montana were revising their management plans. And during that process, they're required to make recommendations for wilderness. Their previous plans had recommended the Scotchman Peaks as wilderness. We formed to make sure that the new plans included recommendations that were at least as strong, if not stronger, than the previous plans. And when we started, we thought that planning process was supposed to take 3 years and be done by 2007 or eight. And our wilderness proposal, pretty naively, we figured Congress would act in 3 to 5 years and we'd be done by 2010. Well, lo and behold, things move more slowly when working with the federal government. We all found out that forest plan wasn't signed until 2015, 12, almost 13 years after the planning process started. And we're still waiting for congressional action on wilderness, which we'll get into, but that's a long process to get a wilderness designated.
So Phil, what drew you to the Scotchman Peaks?
So all my life, I grew up experiencing wildlands. From the ripe old age of four, my dad took me out on a 3-mile nature walk in a state park in Virginia. And I just absolutely fell entranced with the idea of this area that had no people around it, even this small state park. And then when I was around 10, we paddled the Allegash River in Maine, in northern Maine, just 2 years after the Wild and Scenic River Act included the Allegash as one of the first designated wild and scenic rivers. And we went days without seeing people. 2 years later, we were paddling in northern Ontario in Canada and went 2 weeks without seeing anyone on the Mississippi River. And eventually we hiked portions of the Appalachian Trail through the White Mountains in Vermont, through the Green Mountains in Vermont, the White Mountains in New Hampshire, and Mount Katahdin in Maine. And I fell in love with that trail. I flash forward to my 30s and I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail, the entire length from Mexico to Canada, which traverses about 40 wilderness areas. And then a few years later, with my soon-to-be wife, we hiked the Appalachian Trail, which crosses another 25 wilderness areas. And then the Continental Divide Trail in chunks. Through all of those hikes, we found a lot of great examples of lands that were preserved and managed for their wilderness characteristics and their not just scenic value, but for the species that live there. And we saw some bad examples, too, of land management, some examples of multi-use that really didn't work for any of the users. when we moved to North Idaho in 2002, we ran into this stunning country around here, including the Scotchman Peaks, which have every species that was present at the time of first European settlement from Lewis and Clark on still intact. Some of the wildest land we had encountered in the lower 48 states, right here in our backyards. And none of it was permanently protected. A light bulb went off, and I felt like I had to give back something to those who would come later on, our kids, our grandkids, so that they could have the same kinds of experiences that I had had the pleasure of growing up. They could have their 3-mile nature walk. They could grow into this long trail experience. They could have these experiences with wild animals in solitude, all right here in our backyard. It would be available, but the certainty that it would be available would only be assured by including this area, these areas, into the National Wilderness Preservation System. And that takes an act of Congress. And it turns out that takes longer than 3 to 5 years to get Congress to act.
Help us understand where the Scotchman Peaks are in Idaho. Idaho being a gigantic state, and you know, I don't think I've been up in this region yet. So could help me understand where it is.
So we are in the Northern Panhandle, which, just to give you a general description of the north part of Idaho, is very different than central or southern Idaho. It's defined by topography, geography. We are lower in elevation. We're wetter in climate. We are influenced by the Pacific Maritime systems coming in. We have a fairly wet spring, fall, and winter. The rainiest spot in all of Idaho is one of the valleys on the west side of the Scotchman Peaks. Annually, it gets almost 100 inches of rain. The 24-hour maximum amount of rainfall in Idaho is 9.6 inches, also experienced in the Lightning Creek drainage. So we're wet. We grow a wide variety of trees, being at lower elevation, instead of the somewhat monocultures of lodgepole pine or whitebark pine that we see in some places in mountain ranges in the west. We have a dozen tree species competing for dominance on many microsites here. So it's a very interesting flora that exists. The mountain range that the Scotchman Peaks are in is in the West Cabinets. It sits astride the Idaho-Montana line, just south of Canada. So when you're standing on top of the namesake peak, the Scotchman Peaks, we can see north into Canada, east into Montana, west into Washington State, and it's all right around us here that this is happening. These high peaks, the Scotchman Peaks, are the most prominent peaks, the tallest in the southern half of the West Cabinets, which are a sedimentary chain of mountains lying just north of the Bitterroot. And interesting, in our area, we have also the Selkirk Mountains, another predominant chain that's well known throughout the state. And that's almost all granitic rock, two real completely different geographical incidents that gave rise to the formed by glaciers that came down that created the Purcell Trench in the valley between the two and carved out Lake Ponderay, one of the deepest and largest lakes in the west. So we have these incredible mountains, a little lower in elevation than the Rockies to the east of us. These deep lakes, these deep valleys that are wet and hold tons of trees, and lots of varied wildlife. From there, we have the grizzly bear, we have Canadian lynx, we have wolves before they were reintroduced to the central part of the state. The last remaining herd of caribou in the Selkirks, which is now moved north into Canada, but still in the basic vicinity. All of these critters make it a really interesting area. You can walk out on any trail in our neighborhood, and you might not be the person at the top or the critter at the top of the food chain.
Not so bad.
It sounds great.
it's a good reminder that, you know, we don't have to always be number one on the food chain.
Well, I don't know that I totally agree with you, Peter. But I was thinking the setting that you're describing is a place I want to go see. I haven't been up. I honestly haven't been up, you know, Sandpoint and points north. It really sounds very different from what I would expect to see in, like you're saying, in central Idaho. I've spent a fair bit of time in those reaches, and certainly in the southern part. The idea that it's super wet up there and has that Pacific Northwest climate. So snowfall, you must get an incredible amount of snowfall.
Yeah, there's high annual variability, but again, to the general wetness, we are lying in a band that's called the interior wet belt or interior rainforest that exists in patches on down to the Clearwater country, but we're really at the heart of it for the United States. And so It creates this wide variety of things, but we are defined by deep snowpack. We do get most of that precipitation in the form of snow in the winter, and then in pretty heavy spring rains right on through June and picking up again in November. But our snowpack can range 300 to 400 inches. It's pretty common through most of the mountains right around here. Some years it's off, and of course that can be troublesome, but we do have these big drainage systems within the Lake Pendre Basin, within the Coeur d'Alene Basin, the Priest Lake Basin, the interior Columbia, which is really what defines our area, has its own unique ecosystem.
So we kind of mentioned earlier that with the Friends of the Scotchman Peaks, that you're moving towards a designated wilderness area. But what else do you do with your organization?
That's a perfect segue. So in order for Congress to act on wilderness, our congressmen need to think that it's important to the local citizens. And there's a raft of political theory behind that. But at the end of the day, congressmen and senators will generally do things that they think their constituents want and avoid those things that they don't think their constituents want them to do. So it's really important we have a chorus of local voices who are not only supportive of the concept of wilderness, but actually pressing the idea on our senators and congressmen. Well, that means getting out into the public and doing education and outreach like most nonprofits that do public awareness. The most effective way to have people understand the value of wilderness is transformational experiences, or put another way, get them out there hiking into the area. In order to get them out there hiking into the area, we also need to have trails open, which is another way to engage them. So we do group-led hikes. We produce a map so that people can go out there on their own. We do trail maintenance to keep the trails open and also to engage people in a little sweat equity. Some of our most ardent supporters are those who have gone out and put a little bit of time in on the Pulaski or the crosscut saw. We have what we call our trail ambassadors who hike the namesake trail, Scotchman Peak, to tell people, no, it's a bad idea to let goats lick you. They have sharp horns and you might get hurt. And we're all smiling because we think that's common sense, but look at the buffalo gorings that occur in Yellowstone every year. It's very similar. So we have trail ambassadors who talk to over 1,000 hikers every year on the Scotchman Peak Trail. We do wildlife education year round, but we focus on youth in the winter. Get our rural youth out into the winter, appreciating nature, taking home the lessons they've learned about tree identification, avalanche awareness, the importance of snowpack, mammal adaptations. These are things that enhance their understanding, the kids' understanding, the family's understanding, and then their connection to the landscape, and by extension, why it's important that we conserve these areas for the critters that call them home, for the trees that are there. So we do that form of outreach, and those four programs keep us really busy year round. We have 15 scheduled hikes this winter.
That's impressive. How large is your group of friends?
So we're not a membership organization. We do ask people who want to support us to sign up as a friend, receive our information through weekly emails that talk about activities and events, or quarterly newsletters that can be emailed or printed. When we started, we used that model because we didn't want to limit supporters to just those who had $20 in their pocket and were the same people supporting all environmental organizations. We wanted to broaden the field, if you will. We didn't want cost to be a barrier. We didn't want the feeling that someone was joining an environmental organization to be a barrier. So we simply wanted supporters or friends. We started off with that thinking we wanted at least 1,000 or 2,000 people to have the influence we need in Congress. We're currently at 10,880 and continue to grow at about 700 a year. 80% of those live within 2.5 hour drive. So draw a circle around the Scotchmans that includes Spokane, Kalispell, and Missoula inwards. And we have over 8,000 people, which is pretty remarkable when you consider how sparsely populated North Idaho and Northwestern Montana are.
Well, I wanted to ask that question. When I think of the North, I can't place large cities right next to it, but you just described a few, you know, major metropolitan areas. What kind of pressures from outside could encroach or bring population into that potential wilderness area?
Yeah, we're seeing right now a huge influx of people into our rural communities since the pandemic began. People who are appreciating the value of connecting outdoors, people who might have had second homes here, who moved their kids to Idaho because they could participate in school sports in 2020 where they couldn't in Washington. Or suddenly they found online commuting for their job was possible where it hadn't previously. There's various numbers out there, but there's huge pressure for growth in our smaller towns in North Idaho and northwestern Montana. And so while the absolute numbers may be pretty low, I saw a statistic last year that suggested Sandpoint, at just under 10,000, was the fastest growing micropolitan area in the country. And when you add 2,000 new people into a town of 8,000 in the span of a year and a half, the pressures that come from housing needs, come from the infrastructure needs. Eventually, the threats to our public lands in the future are probably less likely to be from resource extractive industries. They've settled into areas that are suitable for timber production or mining or grazing. Our remaining roadless lands that are eligible for wilderness are generally those activities aren't found there. But we have pressures from motorized users, from snowmobilers, from motorcycles, ATVers. We have developmental pressures. There have been any number of proposals in the last 20 years to sell off our public lands in whole or in chunks. And while we sometimes look at that and go, that'll never happen, I sat through a process in 2008 that had parceled out 38,000 acres in Bonner County that got to the stage of almost final approval under the Bush administration. It can happen. I watched when I was growing up in my later 20s in Colorado, favored trails that were absolutely deserted in 1985. And when my wife and I went back to hike the Continental Divide Trail in 2010, we're overrun by 200 or 300 different motorcycles, quads in what had previously been backcountry. That's a future we want to avoid for at least the areas we cherish the most in North Idaho. I'm not saying there shouldn't be places for motorized recreation. There should be. There should also be places where we go that are beyond that motorized mayhem, where silence is what rules, where we can hear ourselves think, where we can share the space with the animals that really require those silent landscapes. So the pressures we are facing are ones that we anticipate to have in the future if we don't check at the door and manage the growth in the numbers of people and the forms of activities that are occurring with that influx of affluence that has the wealth to purchase those machines.
You know, the other part that I really enjoy and is a benefit for the Friends of the Peaks is, it's like you said, it's a working organization. And so you've got thousands of members and they're going out helping maintain trails. They're out on hikes. They're leading hikes. They're developing ownership within the peaks. And as you have these outside forces, in a sense, coming in and putting pressure on different ways of using the peaks and the trail systems, you've already built this large group of advocates for the peaks that say, hey, we hear you, but not here. You want to join us? Let's develop some motorized trails over here and maintain this. And I really hope that can slow down some of those concerns.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And the program I'm most proud of is our Winter Tracks Youth Education. We're in our ninth year. We work with Dow for the last 3 years and going forward, about a dozen schools here in Bonner County, Idaho, Sanders, and Lincoln County, Montana. We've taken them out on 14 field days last year and this year, and included over 500 students. To do that, we have over 40 volunteers from all walks of life, including folks who are working currently with the state and federal agencies that manage the land and the wildlife. We have folks from the Army Corps of Engineers, Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, Idaho Department of Fish and Game, the Forest Service. We have retirees from the Idaho Department of Lands, from, again, the Forest Service as an agency, who have all this specialized knowledge and passion for the jobs they do and can bring them forward to help the children of our area. And to me, it's so vital to connect our communities that way. A fifth grader going through school in Libby, Montana, in the last 8 years, every fifth grader who's gone through Libby, Montana's elementary school has participated in our winter tracks. So when we start to have that reach in the community, we can really unite folks from a broad variety of backgrounds. It is, we try to depoliticize this to the highest degree possible on our board and amongst our supporters. We have some of the very most conservative folks in our region. In addition to those who people might normally or naturally suspect would be supportive of wilderness, but we truly have people from all walks of life, all social, economic, political backgrounds. That is the chorus of voices that's going to make action inevitable for our politicians. Since our country was founded, Congress has passed only about 4% of the bills that ever come out of it are introduced to come out as law, one in 25. That statistic has stayed relatively true for over 200 years. And so it's easy to look at Congress and say it's dysfunctional because these bills are introduced and never come out. That's the way it was designed. It was intended to slow down the legislative process so that laws wouldn't just come out willy-nilly. They'd be very thoughtful and had gone through a lot of vetting.
Well, so I'm wondering if there are any obstacles. It's a slow process, but, you know, are there specific obstacles to getting passage, or is it a matter of prioritization and it just doesn't rise to the top? Is it that?
The biggest obstacle in our early days, and I'd still argue this is the biggest obstacle, is simply political inertia. There are so many issues out there that Congress can and should act upon to become the one that is so important to a senator or congressman. They spend the time and the political capital on it. Means you have to really rise above the din. So for action to happen, it has to be important to people. And so overcoming that inertia takes time to build that importance within the community.
If you had the chance to take somebody who hadn't been to Scotchman Peaks before and you could make the perfect day, what are some of the things that you would hope they'd see or experience?
I would get them off trail. As nice as the trails are and the summit peaks are stunning, they can see photos of the panoramas and somehow appreciate them. But to get them back into the woods, where even if we don't see a wild animal, the hair on the back of your neck will raise up a little when you hear a twig snap, just thinking what it might be. And if we get lucky and we see a wolf print in the mud, or we hear a growl from a mountain lion, that's all the better. But chances are really good in certain places in the backcountry we'll at least encounter a black bear, if not some evidence of grizzly bears. And so I really like the backcountry non-view areas because it allows our imaginations to really soar in the way that I think they really only can in wild places.
I love it. It's a reminder that we might not be the apex predator.
Exactly.
You know?
I've been in many places like that where exactly what you're saying, it's the unknown. It's a bit mysterious. And you feel very connected and focused because out of necessity. But there's something that's really lovely about that.
Yeah. That or if it's late March, early April, and there's been a recent burn, we'd go morel hunting.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And you never tell where you find them.
No. Never.
No.
Never.
Ever. You have to sign a confidentiality statement.
That's right.
Right, right. No smartphones, no cameras, no GPSs.
Well, you're convincing me I need to make a trip up north.
Come on up. We'll go out. If it's not one of our scheduled hikes, I'll find time in my calendar to get out there.
That's wonderful.
I have a feeling that you would find time to get out and hike no matter what your calendar says.
And one of my favorite parts about my job is introducing people to the area.
That's great. Well, can you help us with our trivia question that we started off today? So the Wilderness Act was signed into law on September 3rd, 1964. The question is, what other significant act was signed into law on that date?
It was a really momentous day. The Civil Rights Act was also signed on September 3rd, 1964.
Well, Phil, we really want to thank you for joining us today. And for all our listeners who want to learn more about the Scotchman Peaks, please visit scotchmanpeaks.org. And if you fall in love with them, which you will, you know, volunteer, get up there, help with some of the trails and some of the education classes as well. So we're, what are we, a couple hours, 2.5, 3 hours away?
Oh, it's not far.
It's not far at all.
Not far.
You know? Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity, Lee, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University, with editing and production done by Ricky Colapietro. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock.
audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org or from Spotify and other select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noid-kisu@isu.edu.